This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Well, the things that used to not matter in the markets are now starting to matter, whether it's political discord, higher oil prices, or trade. Markets not liking this, with the blue chip averages breaking down and back into negative territory. Joining me on the program from Asbury Research is John Kosar. John, I want to talk about some of the big blue chip averages, and that is the breakdown of the Dow Industrials and the Dow Transports. They've broken through their 50-day, and recently they've broken through their 200-day moving average. What do we make of this?
Well, I think, you know, generally speaking, I just went through a bunch of charts here just before you called, and the SOX index, which is a big one for me, that's the semis, the NYSE, the Dow Industrials, and there's a world index ETF that I track. It's URTH is the symbol. Those are all sitting on or just kind of easing underneath their 200-day. The Dow Transports, there was a bullish breakout. There was a bullish pattern there that failed as of today. So, you know, there's a failed pattern in France, just kind of jumping overseas for a second. There's a failed pattern in the French ETF. And the reason I look at some of these globals is because, especially the ones that happen to be positively correlated to the S&P 500. So what I make of all of this is that it looks like our market is rolling into correction, and it looks like the cleanest shirt in a dirty hamper, to use that old saw, but, you know, just kind of going around the globe, you know, global indexes, Europe, China, Japan, most of those indexes are already significantly underneath their 200 days. And again, the correlations between these markets and ours is, depending on which index you're looking at, varies. But I mean, we generally move up and down in stocks over the globe at the same time. So I don't think this bodes well.
And when we take a look at the things that are still doing well and have done well, at least they're still in positive territory, it's been the NASDAQ and it's been the small cap indexes, but even things like the Russell are starting to look like they're heading down. How serious would that be if they break down and go through their 200-day moving averages?
Yeah, you know, we're a ways from that happening, but it's a really interesting point and something that I was looking at this morning. Generally speaking, in a healthy bull market, most of the time, you're going to get leadership from technology and secondarily, oftentimes from small cap. What do I mean by that? I mean that usually you'll see the Russell and the NASDAQ 100 or the comp outperforming the S&P 500 in a healthy uptrend. Those typically lead. You also get some leadership from semiconductors as well. I have some indicators here that I put together that basically tracks the relative performance of small cap and tech versus the S&P 500. So I can get a sense of where they are kind of in their quarterly cycle. And both tech and small cap are technically overextended on a quarterly basis versus the S&P. What does that mean? It means that if those two leaders, even though they're still outperforming and they still look good kind of relative to the rest of the market, if they stop being the leaders, if they start to underperform, I think that's what could push a decline in the broad market kind of into second gear. It's in first gear right now. It's just kind of unable to keep its head above water. You know, the S&P has been grinding sideways for months and months, but that's a worry to me. If those two leaders are historically at a place where they peak relative to the S&P and start to roll over, that could be a catalyst to kind of kick this into a new gear on the downside.
I want to talk about something else that we're starting to see. You know, the Fed had its meeting last week, and what struck me was they removed accommodative language. They got rid of forward guidance. They increased their dot plot going to four hikes. And then in January, they're going to start having press conferences accompanying every FOMC meeting. So if you look at that meeting itself, it came across as hawkish. Although recently, one Fed governor saying if this trade stuff keeps up, maybe we need to pull back our stance on whether we go three or four. So let's talk about interest rates here, which have pulled back at least on the 10 and the 30.
Yeah, that's an interesting one. And oftentimes what I've noticed with the interest rate markets is they're very counterintuitive. Like when everybody is really thinking rates are going to go to the moon, that's just the time that they kind of slap you in the head and they turn around and go the other way. I had been looking at a level between 304 and 313 in the 10-year for a couple of months, putting out charts to clients and letting them know that that was a big inflection point. Right when we were in the threes, obviously, that's when the talk of the Fed was raising rates, don't fight the Fed, the market looks great, you know, the economy looks great, you know, go, go, go. That's right about that time that we were up against 313. Well, we traded as high as 311 on a closing basis, and we dropped down quickly, within 8 days, if you can believe that, down to 277. So now we're bouncing around in here. We're in the low 280s the last time I looked. And it looks to me that rates can continue to fall. Again, it's counterintuitive, but it looks like I think we can get the yield of the 10-year to 260, 265. And at that point, you know, then I'm going to kind of take a look at everything and see where things stand. So sometimes a counterintuitive mindset with rates is really very good. So, you know, the question you ask yourself is, all right, so we're at 285 now in the 10 right now. Say we go to 262. So the next question is, what gets you there? In my view, what might help to get us there, if not be a kind of a major catalyst, is if the stock market continues to weaken. Again, you know, the globe has kind of broken down and we're following, or, you know, we're still strong stocks wise relative to most of the rest of the world. But if we continue to weaken here, that's going to push some money out of equities and back into the safety of U.S. Treasuries, which will drive those yields down even farther. So that's kind of how I'm taking two different markets and pairing them up and coming up kind of with a strategic scenario, let's call it, you know, hypothesis of what might happen. And I think we can see that 260 area here this summer. I mean, who knows? You know, the way rates go, they go really quiet for a while and then bam, it's like they jump within just a few days, like the move from 311 down to 277 in the tens. But that's what I'm looking for, is I'm looking for rates to actually drop down into the mid to low 260s here in the 10-year.
Let's talk about what that might imply and whether it's still relevant in this kind of market. And that's an inverted yield curve. Right now, on the day you and I are speaking, there's about a 30 basis point difference between 2-year and 10-year. If your thesis plays out and we get down to 2.6 and we're looking at a 2-year note that is a little over 2.5, and let's say the Fed goes again in September, raises another quarter of a point, what happens when we have a flat yield curve or it begins to invert?
Well, you know, everything that I know about the yield curve is it's not a timing tool. If you try to time the market or put a idea out there in terms of a trade, in terms of an investment, based on what the yield curve's doing now, it's generally not a good idea. It's a forward-looking indicator, and most of the stuff that I've read indicates that after the yield curve turns negative, it could be as much as a year before you go into recession. But that's the implication there, is the flattening curve indicates that the bond market, which is typically more forward-looking than the stock market, is seeing some economic issues ahead, and, you know, it's factoring in those issues in, you know, the way they're pricing treasuries. So realistically, if the curve inverts, you know, it indicates problems around a year ahead, you know, maybe a little bit less than that, but about a year ahead. But maybe some of that warning shot over the bow by the bond market right now is part of what's kind of kept the lid on the stock market rally and has pushed them lower for a while.
I want to move on to something else that's impacting the market. We're seeing it reflected in inflation rates. That's a breakout in crude oil. On the day you and I are speaking, we're looking at crude prices over 73 on West Texas Intermediate crude. And on Brent, we're approaching almost $80 a barrel. And here we are in the middle of summer driving season. I don't know what it's like in your neck of the woods, but in California, we're over $4 a gallon. Let's talk about oil, its impact not only on inflation, but eventually, you know, hitting consumer pocketbooks.
Yeah, I've had my eye on oil for some time. Our last time that we were together was April 18th, and one of the kind of special situations that I had talked about in that interview was a very large net short position by the commercial hedgers, oil hedgers, and they used the futures market for that. And they were holding a record net short position. This is with oil was trading about $60 a barrel, you know, or $55 a barrel. So my thesis then and my thesis now is that if they were wrong, in other words, the reason they were putting out those shorts at around $60 a barrel is because the smart money thought that oil prices were overpriced. Their oil was near a peak in price around $60. Well, they were wrong, and they're wrong to the tune of about $15 a barrel right now. If the market goes high enough, those shorts will have to cover. They'll have to throw in the towel. And if that happens, that could really kind of put the afterburners on this oil rally. So I've seen a little bit of liquidation in those shorts, but nothing like we saw back in around 08, a similar net short position where the hedgers got caught off sides, took oil from $70 a barrel to $130 a barrel. Now, I'm not saying we're going to go to 130. I think we could see 100, especially if we see more liquidation by the shorts. When I was on April 18th, oil prices are up 11% since then, and I had actually mentioned a couple of stocks. I mentioned Anadarko and Hess as two places to potentially put some ideas out there. Anadarko's up 16% since then, and Hess is up 18%. And I still have unmet targets in both of those that are significantly higher than those two stocks are right now. So, big move. I don't think it's over yet. The only place that our indicators, our metrics are showing opportunity here is in oil. And oil is always a tricky one because OPEC is involved and it's not governed by the typical supply and demand. There's other stuff involved there. It's controlled by a small group. But I do like oil, and I have upside targets in a number of stocks and ETFs that have not been hit yet. And oil-related, oil services, oil production are two areas of the energy sector that I really like, and I'm seeing a lot of opportunities in that space.
Yeah, I remember our last conversation in April when you brought up the fact that the commercials had a huge net short position. The last time they had that was back in 2007 and 2008 when oil spiked all the way up to almost $150 a barrel. The other group that has been wrong on this as well is a lot of these companies, especially in the shale space. I was really surprised to find out when we looked at first quarter earnings, John, that a lot of these companies, 15 out of the top 20 shale producers had hedged oil in the 50s. So as oil exploded over 60 and now over 70, they're not capturing those gains because they sold oil forward at a lower price.
That's exactly what I'm talking about. And that $55 area is actually probably where a lot of that hedging took place. I actually figured it out a few weeks ago, just how much collectively in the hole they are, so to speak, on these shorts that are under the market. And I, just off the top of my head, it was in excess of $4 billion. Now, you know, this isn't one hedger. This is a lot of hedgers and a lot of contracts. But that's a whole lot of money. And something interesting that I've seen is oil has had a really nice rally here over this past week or so. But open interest, and again, I don't want to get too wonky here, but futures open interest has continued to contract. And normally when you see a rally like this, you know, you see open interest expanding on a day-to-day basis, which indicates people are buying the futures and holding them overnight. It makes open interest get bigger. It's similar to watching asset flows in an ETF. You see the asset flows expand, that's a good sign because it tells you people are buying the ETF, holding it overnight. And that's kind of trend fuel to keep the ETF going higher. In this case, what contracting open interest amid higher prices means, when you look at the COT data, it means that their short covering is pushing this. So in other words, this looks like the beginning of short covering where the hedgers are starting to throw in the towel on their shorts because open interest isn't going up, it's going down. So they're actually liquidating contracts, selling them at higher prices. If this is the start of a liquidation phase by those hedgers, this thing could go a lot higher than it is right now.
Let's talk about a couple other things that, you know, as we start out this conversation, things that did not matter last year, whether it was political discord, rising oil prices, rising interest rates, didn't seem to matter. This year, those things are starting to have an impact on markets. Let's talk about the dollar, because Wall Street was forecasting higher profits because, you know, when you reduce the tax rates from 35 to 21%, you're going to have higher profits. But a lot of these companies, and maybe this is what we're seeing, John, in the S&P 500, or you're looking at the Dow stocks, a good majority of their sales and profits come from overseas. So if the dollar is on an uptrend, that has got to have an impact on their profits. Taking a look at the dollar today, where we're approaching that 95 level again, what's your take on the dollar here?
My take on the dollar here is for the near to intermediate term, 1 to 3 months out, I'm actually seeing indications that we're making some kind of a near-term peak in the dollar, you know, where the dollar's going to start to pull back here. We follow the dollar kind of secondarily here, and it's difficult to correlate the movements in the dollar with any particular asset. I mean, bonds probably is the one that it correlates to the best, but trying to correlate the dollar to the stock market, you just don't have the statistics there. But what we're looking at is after a really nice move higher in the dollar from mid to late April, I'm looking at the dollar index chart right now. You know, the rally is stalled, momentum is kind of coming out of there, and I see some, again, going back to the commitments of traders data, but you can get an indication of kind of what the smart money is doing, what the institutions are doing. They are actually making short bets on the dollar here, suggesting that at least over, you know, the next 1 to 3 months, the dollar's a little bit overpriced and is likely to pull back a bit.
So going from there, let's go to a final commodity that people follow, and that's gold. Gold has had difficulty breaking out above that 1350 level. And of course, a rising dollar is negative for gold. What's your take on gold? I mean, if the dollar is topping out, could we see a bounce?
Yeah, we could. Gold has been really kind of a disappointment. I'm actually looking at GLD. I'm looking at the ETF. I think, you know, a lot of listeners might follow that even more so than the, you know, the futures contract itself. GLD and gold have really been in a basing pattern since 2016, kind of bouncing around sideways. I had been watching this with interest for some time, and several failed attempts to break out higher. Beginning in late January, there was another one here in mid-February, another really good attempt at a breakout in mid-April. All of them have failed, and it's starting to roll back down. My fear is that any more weakness here, I think the level we really need to watch in gold is you have to watch that low. And again, GLD is what I'm looking at. 117.40 is the December 2017 low. So just about 18 months ago. If we break down through there, if we hold there, great. You know what? If the dollar pulls back, gold and the dollar are inversely correlated to each other. So if this little support level here around 118 even in GLD holds, that might be a near-term place to buy gold. Gold's acting terribly, and I don't advocate any long positions in gold, but you know, depending on what the dollar does, if the dollar pulls back in here, GLD holds 118, we could see a little rally into the summer as the U.S. currency weakens, you know, versus the rest of the world. If we break this 118 to 117.40 area, there could be a lot more pain involved for gold. So I'm not crazy about it, and I wouldn't advocate a buy in gold unless it showed me that it can hold some of the support. And I saw, you know, some weakness in the dollar to kind of support a gold rally. There's nothing here that indicates to me that we're near any kind of a investment time horizon opportunity to buy gold, just maybe a near-term bounce.
Finally, given where the markets are right now, we've got the major blue chip average, the Dow industrials, transports, and utilities in negative territory for the year. You have the S&P 500 holding on to a small gain, the NASDAQ stocks and the small cap stocks obviously doing much better, but still in a downtrend. What would you be doing as an investor here?
What I've been doing lately is we have a model that I had built a few years ago that picks out stocks within a momentum environment. It did very well in 2017, sank 77 picks, and on average, each one beat the S&P by 1.5%, which is very hard to do in a market that goes up all the time the way it did in 2017. I've spent the past 2.5 months this year building a model that works on the premise of value, trying to buy a large decline. By large, I mean maybe 8 to 10% decline in a good stock that's been uptrending for a while, comes into support, and then we start to see some positive momentum characteristics. Frankly, that's been been working pretty well here for the past couple of months, but it's picked out some. So I'm going into the weeds a little bit on you. I've actually built a model that will work better in a sideways to down environment for picking stocks. We call it Asbury Value. And I think maybe that's what you need to do now, is be looking at good stocks that have been in long-term uptrends that have had a 10% pullback and are coming into some support levels. The reason for that is you don't know what the stock's going to do next week or next month. Nobody has a crystal ball that I know of. But if you can buy value breaks, if you could buy a good decline into a support level in a stock that's been strong, for years and years and years, it gives you an opportunity where you can buy a stock with relatively low risk, because at that point, after you buy that kind of a break, if it continues to go lower, you get out and the stock probably rolls into some kind of a negative market, underneath its 200-day, let's say, for the next few months. But if you can buy them there, it gives you an opportunity to buy good stocks at a relatively low-risk opportunity, where if the trend is still intact, the trends typically re-engage very quickly, and many of these that, again, I've only been at this a couple of months, we've got 35 trades closed out so far, but I'd say a quarter of them have risen by 12, 15% or more. So that's what I'm doing now, is rather than trying to buy a momentum breakout, which isn't really working in this environment, is I'm trying to find really good stocks that have had a pretty substantial break and trying to buy them at a value.
Well, listen, John, as we close, if our listeners would like to follow the great work you do at Asbury, tell them how they could do so.
The best way to contact us is through our website, asburyresearch.com, asbury research.com. There's a contact tab there, if you will complete that. And all it is your name and your email address. We will reach out to you and we'll send you some sample reports of what we're doing, some current work, so you can see what we're doing, maybe see some of the charts I was talking about today with crude oil and gold and some of the foreign indexes that I was talking about. You get a little bit of an idea of what we do, and we have a couple of different price points for individual investors, for institutional investors. So get a chance to see what we're doing in real time, and if you like it, we'd love to take you on as a client.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com.
Coming up next in the Financial Sense News Hour, Greg Weldon is Jim's guest as the big picture rolls forward today, taking shelter in the storm as we examine stagflation, rising budget deficits, and higher inflation rates, and discussing why the Fed may be using hawkish language, but not be quite as hawkish as the markets might anticipate. There are new storms that are coming, and the markets aren't discussing them. All of that coming up next on the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com.
The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertised with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.